All right. Welcome. How are you doing today? I was saying this morning, I forgot what 40 degrees felt like, and it was a shocker. I am so excited to be here this morning, and I'm glad that you are here with us as well. If you have your Bibles, you can turn to the book of 2 Samuel chapter 11. And as we get started here this morning, a couple updates for you. So I know last week, if you were here, I announced about the violation we received about this building and meeting here, and maybe you read it in the newsletter and you were wondering, what is going on? So as I mentioned last week, we received a violation that this pop, crack, it's like Rice Krispies. We received a violation that this building isn't zoned properly for religious use. So been making some progress on that this week, and I don't really have too much more to report other than the fact that we're here this week, and we'll be here next week, and continuing to look into staying here as well as other possible locations. So I'll keep you updated with that as we move along. Nothing really too new to report, but we are looking into this simply just being a permit issue and figuring out what does it mean to acquire the permit so that we can continue meeting here at Life. So that's a building update. And then the thing that I'm really excited about, next Sunday, the 28th of October, the Awaken Dojo, all about transformation. How are you transformed? How are you renewed by the transforming of your mind? And so we are going to be about 20 minutes north of here. Maybe it's a little colder up there, I don't know. 20 minutes north of here in Armonk, New York at Hillside Church from 1 to 3. And there's a sign up on the back table. I would love for you to, I've seen that list has grown over the past couple of weeks, which excites me all the more. And there's plenty more white space on that for your name to go on that sheet. And if you do need childcare, please just note that on there so I make sure that we have enough childcare helpers for the kids. There's going to be, it works out perfectly because we're going to be in one room and then we have space for the kids. There's an outdoor playground if the weather is warm enough. And so there's plenty of room at Hillside for all of us. And that will be next Sunday. Now, this morning, we're starting a new series called Will the Real King David Please Stand Up? So over the next 5 weeks, we'll be talking all through the life of King David. Now, King David is someone who has fascinated me for a long time. I have the same name as him, so I think I grew up reading all the stories about David and, whoa, can I be like that? Can I slay a giant? Can I become king? And he has fascinated me to no end. And so a couple of months ago, I came up with this idea to do a series on King David, and I have just been sitting with these stories in his life now for a couple of months, and I am thrilled to have 5 weeks to talk about King David. Now, King David is someone that has fascinated artists, poets, authors for a very, very long time. Maybe you're familiar with this statue right here. Bonus points for anyone who can name the sculptor. Michelangelo. And like double bonus points if you know where this statue currently is. The city of Florence. King David is someone that people, all of us, have just been thinking about and talking about for hundreds of years. A couple of ways that some of his biographers have described him. And quick side note here, so this book that I'm going to quote here first is by Jonathan Kirsch. I believe it's called The Real Life Story of King David. Jonathan Kirsch. Okay, so we're going to be, I don't know what's with the Rice Krispies, maybe we'll figure that one out at some point. But we're going to be with King David for the next 5 weeks, so I highly encourage you. His story is found in 2 Samuel into Kings. Read through the life of David, and if you want a book to go along with your scripture study, Jonathan Kirsch, The Real Life of King David, I believe the name of the book is, just search Kirsch, and you'll find it. Now, this first quote, above all, David illustrates the fundamental truth that the sacred and the profane may find full expression in a single human life. and his biography preserves the earliest evidence of the neurotic double bind that is hardwired into human nature and tugs each of us in different directions at once. Against every effort of Bible-waving moralizers who seek to make us better than we are or to make us feel bad about the way we are, the biblical account of David is there to acknowledge and even affirm what men and women really feel and really do. King David normalizes the human experience. Everything that we're going through, what we feel, what we do, our actions, it's normal. It's part of the human journey. Now, while the Bible doesn't fully condone all of David's actions, what the Bible does tell us is that we're not alone. Whether it's in our best moments or our very worst moments, we aren't the first ones to find ourselves there. But rather, the human journey, it's feelings and actions that are universal to all of us. So King David, as we read through his biography, it normalizes what we go through and tells us we're not the first and we won't be the last. If we go to the next slide, I love this description of David. He was a profoundly simple being, cheerful, despondent, selfish, generous, sinning one moment, repenting the next, the most human character of the Bible. Does this describe anyone else's life here? You're cheerful one moment, despondent the next. You're doing things that, you wish no one would ever find out about. And the very next moment, you're raising your hands, praising God. Yeah, King David is the most human of them all. And then one more quote about David. King David is a symbol of the complexity and ambiguity of human experience itself. Yeah, just when you think you have King David all figured out, all of a sudden he goes and does something else that leaves you scratching your head like, that doesn't line up with who I thought David was. So is David really this terrorist, adulterer, murderer, selfish man full of ambition and pride, or is he, as he's described in the Bible, truly a man after God's own heart? Which one is it, or is it a little bit of both thrown into the mix? Yeah, the ambiguity, the uncertainty, it's what's baked into life itself. And the biography of David paints a picture and says, life doesn't have the simple, nice, neat answers that we all look for. But rather, life is a little more lived in the gray. It's a little more complex. It's a little more ambiguous than it's often made out to be. And so I absolutely love the story of King David. And this is where we're going to sit for the next 5 weeks, all with the question, what does King David teach us about what it means to be human? What can we learn about our own human journey through these stories of David? Now, I thought what I would do is I would start with a very familiar story. And quick disclaimer here. This story has been preached hundreds, thousands of times. And when I first came up with this series idea, I said, I am not going to speak on any of the familiar stories of King David because we've all been there before. And we've mined the depths of what that story has to say. But the more I sat with this story, the more I realized, whoa, there's so much more going on here than how it's normally talked about. So I just have to share this story with you because this is like a modern-day soap opera. It's filled with lust and passion and murder and deceit, all that good stuff that you sit on the edge of your seat looking for Monday afternoon at 1 o'clock in the afternoon when you're home from work. So let's look at the story of David, Uriah, and Bathsheba. And the story picks up in 2 Samuel 11, verse 1. Now in the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. So everyone leaves except David. And so the army destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed. I guess he's kind of a late riser, Can we say this here? One evening, David gets up from his bed. He must have missed morning tea. And he walked around on the roof of the palace. And from the roof, he saw a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful. And so David sent someone to find out about her. And so the man said, "She's Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." So then David sent more men. It's kind of a weird story, is this not? David sent, this is like a modern day mob story right here. Like David's in the mafia, sends one man, find out who that is. And then he sends not just one messenger, but messengers as if she can refuse. This is an offer that she can't refuse. So he sends all these messengers to go and get her. And she came to him, he slept with her. Then she went back home, the woman conceived, and she sent word to David saying, "I'm pregnant." And so David sent this word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent him to David. Now, the story continues from here. If you go to the next slide, I have a couple notes for you. So we have to start. This is how this account starts. In the spring, when the kings go off to war, right in the beginning of this story, we know that something is a little bit off. The storyteller here tells us, this is going to take place in the springtime. This is when all the kings go off to war. Yet what is David doing? He stays home. He stays in the palace. David stays in the comfort of his home. He's got his Wi-Fi. He's got Netflix. He's probably ordering Uber Eats every evening. The fridge is stocked with pints of Ben and Jerry's. Come on. Yes. Probably a little late afternoon tennis, because that's what a king would do. David is there in the palace while all of his men are off fighting a battle, and he's at home in the comfort of his own palace with his Tempur-Pedic mattress. This one line sets up this entire story. Right when you read this phrase, you're thinking, huh, the kings go off to war, but David's at home. This is absolutely a brilliant way to begin this story. And you, what you already know from this is that the storyteller is not approving of David's actions. You already know right from the beginning what the storyteller thinks about David and what he's about to do. Everyone is off fighting a battle. David is at home in his palace. This is a story that is not going to end well for King David. Now, the story continues. Uriah comes home from war, and he gets invited over to David's crib for beer and wings. And David says, "Hey, Uriah, come home. I got some of these atomic wings. I got some great beer. Just come. We're going to have a good time together." So Uriah goes, he gets drunk, and David says, "Hey, I want you to go back and enjoy the company of your wife tonight." Uriah leaves, but instead he has a palace sleepover with all the other guards, and he camps out right at the gate of the palace. He doesn't actually go home. The next morning, David wakes up after maybe he had a hangover as well. I don't know. Him and Uriah, I don't know what they were doing. He wakes up, he finds out Uriah didn't go home, and he asks him, he says, "Seriously, dude? You've just been off fighting in war for who knows how long. You enjoyed all this food with me. I told you go home and spend the night with your wife, and you camp out with all these other dudes at my palace? Like, what's the deal? What are you doing?" And so David says, "You know what? Come over for dinner again tonight." Now, this time, David's not messing around. He goes top shelf, like Johnny Walker Gold for this one here, and worse than the night before. "Hey, Uriah, go home, be with your wife." What does Uriah do? At the palace. When he asks him why, he says, "Well, all of my men, all of my comrades, they're off fighting a war, they're camping out, they're not home, they don't have the luxuries, the comforts of their family, of their wives, and so it would be a disservice if I were to actually spend the night with my wife." Who's the good guy in this story here? Who's the one who's caring about the common good of everyone instead of their own selfish pursuit. Uriah, early on in the story, we see that Uriah the Hittites, who were one of the descendants of the Canaanites, who are not looked upon favorably in the Old Testament, yet it's Uriah the Hittite who is the one who is more God-honoring as this story progresses. So David sends Uriah back to the battle, and he gives him a letter. And he says, hey, Uriah, I want you to take this letter back to Joab, back to the commander of the army. Now, Uriah has absolutely no idea what's in this letter. And if we pick up the story, I believe verse 14, in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab, and he sent it with Uriah. And he wrote, put Uriah out in the front where the fighting is the fiercest. Then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die. Uriah is carrying his own death sentence. He has no idea what's in the letter, but he is delivering this note to Joab saying, basically, put me in the front. And so Joab had the city under siege. He put Uriah at the place where he knew the strongest defenders were. And when the men of the city came out and they fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. Now, after this, the story continues to go to the next slide. A messenger comes all the way from the battle to King David in Jerusalem, and he tells him, the battle's not going so well, but it's okay because your servant Uriah, isn't that a terrible way to, your servant Uriah is the one who is doing your bidding, the one who is serving you, the one who is following you is dead. There's a royal wedding following this where Bathsheba enters into David's harem, I guess we could say, becomes one of David's wives. A son is born, and then a prophet, because not everyone knows about this, but yet a prophet confronts David about what he's just done, and David's just brushing this all off, and all of a sudden the prophet Nathan goes to him, you are the man, David, which we're going to talk about this story actually next week. But he goes to David and says, you're the one who has committed this great atrocity, this terrible act. So David repents as he does. Remember, one moment he's over here doing the worst sinning. The next moment he's repenting. So we see this flip-flop in the story. Unfortunately, the son dies. And then David and Bathsheba decide to try again for another child. And which at this point, another child is born. Now, during this whole time, there are other things that are taking place. So if we look at chapter 12, verse 26, we're told, meanwhile, while all this is happening with David and Bathsheba and their son dying, a new son being born, it says, meanwhile, Joab fought against Rabbah of the Ammonites, and he captured the royal citadel. But Joab then sent messengers to David saying, I fought against Rabbah and I've taken its water supply. Now muster the rest of the troops and besiege the city and capture it. Otherwise, I will take the city and it will be named after me. So David mustered the entire army, went to Rabbah, attacked, captured it. He took the crown from their king's head. It was placed on his own head. It weighed a talent of gold set with precious stones. And David took a great quantity of plunder from the city. He brought out the people who were there, consigning them to labor with saws, with iron picks and axes, and he made them work at brick making. And David did this to all the Ammonite towns, and then he and his entire army returned to Jerusalem. A couple things to note here, if we go to the next slide. Meanwhile, Joab had surrounded this city. He sends messengers to David, and he tells them, hey, come out here yourself. Otherwise, I am going to capture the city, and I'm going to name it after me. Notice, this is what rouses David from his complacency. It's not, hey, I need you to come here because we're losing morale, and we need our leader to come and boost the troops up. We need you to come and walk around and tell everyone how great of a job they're doing for Jerusalem and for our God. No. Rather, it's, hey, if you don't come out here now, I'm going to conquer the city in my name. It's David's lust for power. It's David's pride that finally gets him up off the couch in order to go to where this battle is taking place. This is why David leaves the comfort of his palace, to make a name for himself, to strengthen his power, to increase his power, to become bigger than he already was. See, this is what it's been about the entire time. It's about David protecting his name and growing his name. It's about David having more and more power. All of his soldiers, all of his men were fighting simply so that David could make a name for himself. And through the course of all of these actions, what is David doing? He's back home in his palace, sleeping with the wife of one of his soldiers who is making a name for David. How many countless innocent victims were killed simply so that David could make a name for himself? And what we have here with Uriah, if you go to the next slide, Uriah is the name and the face of all those who have ever been used, manipulated, and stepped on so that those in power can stay in power and increase their power. And we are very clearly told whose side God is on. God is not on the side of those who try to increase their power and don't care who they step on in order to work their way to the top, but rather God is on the side of the victim, of the innocent, of those who have been used, abused, manipulated. Now, I understand that this doesn't happen in our world today. Ooh, this is ancient stuff. We've progressed way beyond this. This is the 21st century. Our leaders don't use people. Our leaders don't abuse their power. Yeah, I get it. See, what this story is, a very strong critique against everyone with any power, with any influence. It was a strong critique back then, but it also serves as a very strong warning for us today. How will we use the power, the resources, the privilege, the wealth that we've acquired in our lives? Now, in order to see the full power of this critique, we need to ask ourselves a question here. And the question is, why was Samuel written? Now, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, they serve as a collection of books. It's four books. Apparently, they didn't get the memo that trilogies were where it was going to be at in the future. So these four books, they're supposed to be seen together. And they were written while the Israelites were in exile. So a little history 101 here. The Babylonians, they come, conquer Israel, and they forcibly remove them from the land, and they drag them all the way out to Babylon. So they are removed from their homeland. They're away from their home. So Samuel and Kings, they were written to answer the question, why are we here in exile? What have we done to deserve this punishment? Why are we so far from our home? This is why you see a difference between the Samuel Kings history and the Chronicles history. If you read the story of Chronicles, it leaves out a lot of David's flaws, including this story with Uriah and Bathsheba, because Chronicles is about something different, which we'll talk about in a couple of weeks. Just set that one to the side. We'll get there. We got 5 weeks here. Can't cover it all in 1 week. But Samuel Kings, they enter into the dark side. Because the story that they're trying to tell is that it's our leaders, it's the flaws of our leaders that dragged us away into exile. It's because of our leaders, because of their actions, because of their dark sides, that we find ourselves in the position of where we are today. And the number one thing that David and all the kings, as we see in Kings and Samuel, the number one thing that they did is they forgot where they came from. They forgot what it meant to be the people of God. If we go back earlier in the story, if we go to the next slide, what do I have? Oh, we're not there yet. But if we go back earlier in the story to the beginning of Israel, what we find in the beginning of Exodus is that the Israelites are enslaved by the Egyptians, by the evil Pharaoh. And what is the evil Pharaoh doing to the Israelites? Forced labor. And he's forcing them to make bricks. If we read this, Exodus 1, chapter 11. So the Egyptians, they put slave masters over the Israelites to oppress them with forced labor. And they worked them ruthlessly, and they made their lives bitter with harsh labor and brick and mortar and with all kind of work in the fields. And as if it wasn't clear enough already, in all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. God comes, rescues the Israelites from slavery, brings them out to the wilderness where they are wandering around for 40 years. They're about to become a nation themselves, and God gives them all these new commands about what it means to truly be human. He gives them these commands. Their mission, if they chose to accept it, was to live in a new way than the way of all the other kingdoms. It was to live in a different way. It was to form a kingdom, form a nation that didn't use power to oppress and abuse others. It was to form a nation that looked after the common good of all people, and not just simply be about themselves. It was this mission to form a kingdom, to form a nation where they would care for everyone, and they would use all the wealth, the resources, the privileges that they've been given in order to see that the entire world, the entire globe, that all people flourished. If we go to the next slide here, Exodus 21. Don't mistreat or oppress a foreigner, for you were foreigners in Egypt. If you do, and they cry out to me, I'll hear their cry, and my anger will be aroused. Don't oppress a foreigner. You yourselves know how it feels to be foreigners, because you were foreigners in Egypt. We fast forward now in the story to Israelites were slaves making bricks, forced labor, taken out, rescued by God, told you're going to form a new kingdom where you're going to look after foreigners. You're not going to oppress anyone. You're going to build a kingdom that seeks to do good, that seeks to represent God through love and mercy and compassion. Now David becomes king of this new kingdom, and what is he doing? Is he not oppressing foreigners? Is he not conquering this city to make a name for himself, number one, but then he is making slaves of the people that he's conquering? And as if this point isn't clear enough, what are they doing as these slaves? He made them work at brick making. This is brilliant storytelling from Exodus to King. It's like there was some spirit that was working the whole thing out. Yeah, the storyteller here is making this perfectly clear. David and the Israelites, they're now the slave masters. They're now doing the very thing that God told them, this is what you aren't to do. Don't you remember how it was when you were in Egypt? And when the Pharaoh in Egypt used their power and they oppressed you and stepped on you to make a name for themselves and make themselves greater and bigger? Don't be like that. Live in a different way. The living God commissions you to be different. And yet David and the kings have forgotten this mandate. They have forgotten what it means to be the people of God. Now, there's lots of ways that we could take this. What time is it, by the way? I mean, I could go on forever, so let me see how much time. Do we want to do like the 5-minute version, or do we want the 10-minute version? Well, the 11-minute version? I can add a minute somewhere in there. Okay, what does this story mean for us? We could take this lots of places, but there's just two places I want to take it quickly. So, muckrakers. When I was in high school, we learned all about these journalists. And I have a definition of muckrakers. I think it was because the name was just so interesting to me. I think about the muckrakers all, I don't know why, but you know how you like think about weird things randomly from your childhood? I think about muckrakers all the time. And I've always wondered, how can I bring a muckraker into a sermon? Now's the time. So the term muckraker was used in the progressive era to characterize reform-minded American journalists who attacked established institutions and leaders as corrupt. One of the greatest examples, remember reading this book, next page, The Jungle, Upton Sinclair. Anyone remember who he attacked? The meatpacking industry. Because he realized that for immigrant workers who were coming over to America and working in the meatpacking industry, the bosses were totally abusing them, horrible working conditions, and actually what ended up getting exposed through his book was how unsafe the food being produced was, and it caused the FDA to then make all sorts of different reforms so that all of us were healthier and didn't have to eat unsafe food. The point of a muckraker, Upton Sinclair included, was to incite societal reform. Pop, there we go. I guess it's making that point clear. Incite societal reform. All right, didn't work that time. And what's happening here is that Upton Sinclair and all these other muckrakers were looking at whether it was the government, any industry, any organization, any group of leaders, people who had power, people who had influence, and they were seeing how they were abusing their influence, how they were abusing their power in order to cause harm to people. And they wanted to expose this. So that which was kept in the dark, they wanted to expose it and bring it out into the light so that everyone could be aware of it. And so there could be this social uprising where everyone could say, that's not right. We care about humans. We care about others. And we are not going to let this continue. And so the muckrakers, they spent their lives as journalists trying to expose the dark underbelly of whether it was the government, an institution, or an organization. This is what the story of David and Uriah is all about. I would argue that this storyteller here is one of the first muckrakers. How is it that we have the contents of this letter that David sends to Joab on the field? This is a state secret. This isn't public knowledge. Yet we're being told exactly what's in the contents of this letter that was supposed to be just between David and Joab, yet somehow this has become common knowledge. And the author says this isn't right. Everyone needs to know about this. As a society, as a nation, we need to know what David did because we need to hold our leaders accountable. We need to hold those who have power accountable to their actions. We can't let them just simply go and use their power however they want to use it, so that they can make a name for themselves at the expense of us, the common people. So I would argue that one of the first things that this story does for us is it tells us you must be a muckraker. And that we, as citizens, as people of God, we are responsible. We're to hold our leaders accountable. And that when we see an abuse of power, whether it's in a large-scale way or whether it's just simply maybe in a family setting or in a smaller business setting, we're to call it out and we're to expose it because we are to care about the common good of all people and that together, collectively, we are to ensure that all people can flourish. And that all people have access to the things that they need in life. And when any organization or any institution cares simply about their own selfish gain and not others, we're to call it what it is. Because God stands for justice. And God calls us as the people of God to be about justice and to ensure that all people are cared for. And the second point I want to make about this story has to do with this inner tension. I read the story. I began seeing this way a couple of weeks ago, and I finished most of the sermon except this last part of it, because the truth about this is this sermon haunts me. Because the more I think about this, I realize I am King David in the palace. I'm white. I'm male. I'm straight. I'm American. I live here in Westchester County. I don't have to worry about where my next meal is going to come from. I have access to clean drinking water. Reese is going to grow up in a great neighborhood, a safe neighborhood. He's going to get an amazing education. I pay money to lift heavy objects. I mean, I'm the epitome of privilege. And when I read this story about King David in the comfort of his palace, abusing his power, this story gets under my skin, because I realize I have my own palace. And oftentimes I stay in the comfort of my palace at the expense of being involved in some of the real urgent needs of the world. So as I think about this story, there's three questions I put together that I am wrestling through myself. And here's the truth, I don't have answers for these. And I don't think that's the point. I don't think the Bible comes with one straight answer. I don't think that's the point of the Bible, just to simply hand you something. I think the Bible is messy, and the Bible leads you places, and then it invites you to figure out what it means for you in your life. And so three questions that I'm wrestling through from this story. Next slide, actually. In what ways have I numbed myself to the real needs of this world by staying within the comfort of my own palace? See, the longer David stayed in his palace, the more he made it about himself. And the more numb he became to real people and what they were going through. His men were off in the field fighting. It was cold, probably camping out, didn't have the comforts of home. David was completely removed from what that was like. Second question. Have I in any way used my power, my wealth, my privilege, resources to make a name for myself at the expense of others? Is there any way that I've used what I've been given to care solely for myself and not for the common good of this world? And then a third question. How can I use my power, wealth, privilege, resources to bring the healing power of Christ to this world? This is why God called the Israelites to be different. To show the world who the living God truly was. There were all these false, toxic views of what the gods were like. The true living God speaks through all of that and says, I want to form a nation. I want to form a people who will truly represent what I am like to the world, who will use their power to bring about justice and mercy and grace and love for all people. And so how is it? I think as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus, one of the greatest questions we can ask ourselves is, how can we use that which we've been given to bring the healing power of Christ to the world around us? See, this story is often talked about in a way, don't murder, don't commit adultery, and even if you mess up, God will forgive you. And all those are true. They're all true. But I think there's more going on here than those truths. And this isn't just one of those stories that you just breeze right through. Great, got the details, I know what happens, on to the next. But rather, it's stories like these that ask us to sit, take our shoes off, grab a cup of coffee, and be there a while. Spend some time in prayer, in self-reflection, in conversation with others, asking, what does this story mean for me? What is the Spirit trying to speak to me through this story? And the great news is there's a community group on Wednesday night where you'll come up with all the answers to those questions. Right, Debbie? Let me pray here for us this morning. God, I thank you for today. God, I thank you that we can be here. I thank you for this story of David and, God, just what this teaches us about our human journey. God, someone who is looked upon so favorably can be so off. And so, God, I pray that as we are here over these next couple of weeks, God, that your Spirit would speak to us about our own journeys. God, maybe where we have forgotten. God, where we have gotten lost in the woods. And I pray that your Spirit would bring us back onto the road that you are calling us on. So God, may we be a people, individually and communally, who use what we've been given for the good of this world, to bring the power of Christ to this world. And God, I pray that we would be a people who would call out injustice, who would call out abuse, God, so that all people can flourish and all people can see the true picture of the living God. So may you use this community to bring that true picture of you to the world around us. We pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.